From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour, starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Namdi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Hello, everybody.
Joining us later in the broadcast will be Janice Lewis George, a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 4. And joining us now is Penelope Gross, the vice chair of the Fairfax County Board of Supervisors, representing the Mason District. Supervisor Gross, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
Tom Sherwood, before we go specifically to Fairfax County, let's talk a little bit about the settling of the HBCU federal lawsuit in Maryland for $577 million. This issue has been around, it seems like forever, but it's been at least a decade or so since it's been around.
It's been around since 2006. A coalition of a group called the Coalition for Equity and Excellence and the Lawyers Committee on Civil Rights under the law filed suit against the state, saying that the state routinely and systematically underfunded and undercut course offerings at historically black higher learning schools while favoring majority white institutions. It's been in the court. Last year, the General Assembly agreed to pay the money, this $577 million in the settlement. Governor Hogan vetoed that. He only wanted to pay $100 million. Then he said he'd pay $200 million. So this year, the legislature overrode the governor's veto for the full $577 million, and Brian Frost, the attorney general, reached the settlement. It's really important because it's an example of the systemic racism that people say permeates government and corporate decisions everywhere. And thousands of students who went to these four schools, Bowie State, Coppin State, Morgan State, and the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, lost out on programs that they could have done. The schools lost out on students who could have gone there. So this is a long-term settlement over the next several years where the state, these schools will get the money. But it is a huge, big deal.
Total of $577 million. And why are Arlington residents being asked to vote on a new logo for the county, Tom Sherwood?
Well, you know, this is a serious issue, but, you know, whenever you change a logo or a sign, remember when the Bullets changed to the Wizards and they and their symbol? You remember the creation of President Trump's Space Force and that spacey-looking symbol that he started? And remember the new Coke? Well, Arlington last year, this is much more serious than New Coke. Arlington last year, the board members decided that their display of Lee House, which is the home of former Confederate General Robert E. Lee, was not in keeping with the diversity of the times, of modern times, and so they've gone set about trying to change it. Well, after lots of recommendations, they've come up with five symbols, new symbols of Arlington that people can vote on till the end of May. And people are complaining like hell about them. Some people are saying that a couple of them have a swoosh like Amazon, as if Amazon already wasn't eating Arlington County. Now the symbol would look like an Arlington package on your front doorstep. Other people said it looks like a grammar school, primary school color chart. So there's been a lot of complaining. You have until the end of May to go online and vote for it if you like, and then the board will make a decision. But the underlying important point is they want to change it, but what it's going to be, I don't think we know yet.
And I think you have a question or comment about another county's logo that Penny Gross might be able to answer. Go ahead.
Yes. First of all, Board Member Gross, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
You hear me okay?
Yes,
okay, great.
Just fine.
Thank you. In researching you and Fairfax County for today's show, I looked up the Fairfax County seal, which is after the sixth Earl of Fairfax from England or whatever. And it has that family's coat of arms. And I'm just wondering, given the changing times, if maybe Fairfax County not change its name, but maybe change the seal and move away from that historic image of the person who started Fairfax County and owned slaves.
Thank you, Tom. Actually, I'd like to get rid of the color orange that is surrounding our seal, because I've never thought that that was a very attractive color. But, you know, about a year ago, maybe it was more than a year ago, the board set up a community group to, or actually they charged the History Commission with looking at all of the various potential Confederate names of streets and locations in Fairfax County. And the History Commission came back with a 500-page report. It was a fascinating walk through history. I found out about things in my district and was like, oh, how that's how that got that name. And so we're going through all of that. We have a community group set up to look at changing the names of two specific highways, Lee Highway, and which is also Arlington Boulevard, and also Lee Jackson Highway, which is further out in the county. And so I think as we move through this process, we probably will have some of those discussions about the county seal. That has not been a front and center option right now, but it is sort of has to be folded into, I think, what we're doing overall, that as a result of the demands to change school names, to change street names, to look at everything historically that has been named for people, locations, events, and so forth. So I imagine that we will have that conversation at some point.
I was mainly surprised that the symbol, the Thomas Fairfax, the sixth Lord of Fairfax of Cameron, that the seal was only adopted in the 1960s. This is not something that goes back to the 1700s and the land around Fairfax now. It only goes back to the 60s, and so it seems the seal is out of date or out of place now. Thank you very much for your answer.
Sure.
And Supervisor Gross, you've been on the Fairfax County Board of Supervisors for, some 25 years, and somehow we have never had you on the show. So before we dive in, tell our audience a little bit about yourself, both your political career and your life outside it.
Sure, I'm happy to. And I have been invited in the past to be on your show, but I discovered that actually this month, April this year, has five Fridays. I'm usually always tied up with meetings on Fridays, but this is a fifth Friday, so I don't have a regular meeting. So that made me fair game for you.
Oh, so it's not all our fault. Good. Thank you.
No, it's not all your fault. I have been in politics all of my adult life. I've been in elective politics since I got my political science degree at the University of Oregon and walked across the stage with that sheepskin. And I came to Washington because I knew that there were no opportunities for young women in politics in my home state of Oregon. You could go to the state capitol, be a secretary, or you could come to Washington, D.C. and be a secretary. I opted to come to Washington, D.C. Got a wonderful job on the Hill with my home state senator, Senator Wayne Morse, in the middle of the Vietnam War. And he was one of the great Vietnam War. He opposed the war. And so it was a wonderful time to be in Washington. It was very exciting. Stayed on the Hill, worked for Senator Frank Church of Idaho. Lost my job with both of them because they both got defeated at the end of 24 years. And so then I worked on the House side for a friend who was also an Oregon congressman. And then, put my own name on the ballot. I'd worked for other people for so many years, and finally, when the opportunity came to run for local office, I decided to do it. And people around me said, "What took you so long?" This is something that I have enjoyed all of my life. I think elective politics is a fascinating field to be in. It's hard work. There are highs and there are lows, but it's something that I've just been doing all my life. And I really hope that I am making a difference. Personally, we have two daughters. My husband and I just celebrated our golden wedding anniversary, and there isn't a whole lot of spare time. I just be supervisor and try and be out there in the community.
Our guest is Penelope Gross, Vice Chair of the Fairfax County Board of Supervisors. When you won election to the board in 1995, you flipped the board from majority Republican to majority Democrat. Talk a little bit about how Fairfax County and its politics have changed over the past 25 years since you were first elected.
Thank you. You know, we have a much more diverse community than we did even 25 years ago. And I think that my election, I always knew that Mason District was a Democratic district. I had done all my background for going 10 years prior to my race in 95. And in almost every case, except for the supervisor's race, the electorate voted for the Democratic candidate in whatever, you know, election it was. The challenge was that the popular candidate in the supervisor race always was Tom Davis. So Tom Davis was the Mason District Supervisor for 12 years. He was succeeded by someone, Tina Trapnell, who was on his staff. But I knew that we had a Democratic district. So when I ran in an open seat, because I announced against the incumbent, and after I started knocking on doors in her neighborhood, she dropped out. So it was an open seat, and I won it narrowly, only by 327 votes. I have never allowed that margin to be that narrow ever since. But we have a growing diversity in our community, and a lot of them are, you know, the real people issues, that the pocketbook issues that affect everyday life. And so I think that as we have become a more urbanized location, Northern Virginia overall has become more Democratic over time. I think that that has had, you know, the diversity has had a good deal to do with it. Now, having said that, I would not be at all surprised at some point where the pendulum swings another way. That is what has happened over time, over many years. You've seen areas that have been Democratic become a little more Republican, and areas that are Republican become a little more Democratic. I like to find that sweet spot in the middle, which allows us to really govern with, you know, a balance rather than everything on one side or everything on the other.
You mentioned former Republican Congressman Tom Davis, who probably regrets giving Tom Sherwood his phone number because Sherwood now has him on speed dial.
I did call former Congressman Davis. He had nice things to say about you. He said you helped create a park district there in the Mason district.
But there were
Republicans. Let me make it clear for people who don't know your Mason district. You live in, I think it's Lincolnia, I believe it is,
north of
Springfield.
Yes.
I looked at the census numbers. It doubled from 2000 to 2010. So I don't know how many people live there now, but I know there's a lot. But he said that you are well known, even among people who don't agree with you, that you are just a good, strong community servant and have been all your life. So that's from Tom Davis.
And thank you for that, because, you know, you've been asking me about my other personal things, and I was really focused on my political life. All the time I was working on the Hill, I was also very involved in the community. I was the PTA president. I was the Civic Association president. I'm one of the founders of the Friends of Mason District Park, which was what Tom had talked about. And that's when I first really got to know Tom. And so there have always been I am a strong believer in having a community resume before you run for office. Okay, it's not just enough to want to run for office. You have to have a community resume.
We've been very nice. Now I've got to ask you a question. I looked at the April 27th Board of Supervisors meeting last night online, and that was where you did a work session, a markup session on the budget that you have to approve next week, I think. You were pretty tough. There are 10 members of the Board of Supervisors. There's only one Republican, Pat Harity. He made some proposals to cut the school budget, among other things. And you were polite, but you were quite firm in shutting him down. And the end of it was the 10 members voted. It was 9-1 against Pat Harity. Is he a dinosaur in Fairfax County? Is there room for Republicans like Pat Harity, who's been on the board since 2007?
my Democratic colleagues might not like this answer, but I do think there is a space for Republicans on any kind of board. There's got to be a diversity of opinion on a board. And there's a healthy tension sometimes when you have different parties represented on a board. Sometimes you can sit on a board like at I'm on the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments board, have been for decades. I sometimes know where my colleagues on that board are as far as their political leanings, but sometimes I don't know. It's really, there's a healthy tension. Sometimes there is a lot of theater to it. But in this particular case that you're referencing, I was chairing that portion of the meeting because the chairman, Jeff McKay, is also our budget chairman. And so he made the motion. And so I was chairing because the chair doesn't chair when he's making the motion. So I always get to do the budget piece. And so there was some theater, I think, in this one. And we pretty much shut that down because Supervisor Harrity, quite frankly, had tried to give us that information the previous week. We were not really inclined to accept any of his recommendations, although there were a couple there that actually had already been placed in our budget guidance. So yes, I believe there is room for a diversity of opinion, whether you are a Republican, a Democrat, or an independent, or some other thing. I think that you only get to a good spot by having a variety of opinions to digest and finally make decisions.
The Fairfax County Board of Supervisors appointed former Baltimore City Police Commissioner Kevin Davis to be the chief of the county's police department starting next week. When he worked for the Prince George's County Police Department, he was on the receiving end of two civil lawsuits relating to use of force and false imprisonment. The victims in each lawsuit won that case. Did you and your colleagues on the Board of Supervisors know of these lawsuits when you were vetting Davis?
We knew of a lot of background. I can't speak specifically to those two, which were a very long time ago. And I'd like to think that when young officers or young anybody makes a mistake and gets called out on it, they learn something from that mistake that carries on through their professional life. And I think in this particular case, we had some very frank conversations with the new chief as we were interviewing him about some of the things that were in the background. A 26-year-old police officer is going to be a whole lot different than a 30-year professional police chief candidate. There's an awful lot that they can learn over time. And I think in this case that Mr. Clark, who is going to become our police chief on Monday, he's still Mr. Clark. I think that what he learned from that about the need for reform is what is driving a lot of the discussion that we had with him about the need for reform of police departments overall.
Well, the Fairfax County NAACP says they were disappointed in the process that the county used for selecting him, citing lack of transparency during the hiring process. They said, "We do not believe the board conducted as transparent a process as the public deserves." How would you respond to that?
I would respond as the 25-year chair of the board's personnel committee and having gone through, this is my fourth police chief selection over time, we've used pretty much the same process, and actually the process has gotten better over time. There were 275 community meetings and calls, over 450 emails to stakeholders, a survey that received almost 3,000 responses. And, you know, we had an awful lot of input in from the community about what they wanted to see in the next police chief. The interview process itself, the recruiting and interview process is very confidential. We're dealing with people's careers here. So there is not a lot of opportunity. Certainly, we don't want to release names of people that are being interviewed because it could affect their career if they're coming from another agency where they're maybe didn't even know that they were being, their boss didn't know they were being considered. So we've always tried to keep it very, very confidential. The board does the interview process after a pre-selection panel reviews people. We had about 40 applicants, and that was narrowed down to the four candidates that we interviewed. I think there was, there's always, as I said, there's always going to be some baggage for people who have reached the executive level for interviews. But I am confident, as the board is confident, that Mr. Davis is going to do a fine job for the county, and he will address a number of issues that need to be addressed, including morale, recruitment, and the community piece with our diverse community, which he is quite proficient in.
Here is Danny in Annandale. Danny, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Great. Supervisor Groves, I hear you right now talking, and I would say active defense of policing and agent of state violence, that is the former chief of police in Baltimore that y'all have hired. But I don't really hear you as my supervisor here. You talk about in the same way in care and defense of Black and brown communities that are the most harmed by policing, whether it is Natasha McKenna, who was killed here in Fairfax County, Giovanni Martinez, who was also killed here in Fairfax County by police. My question is, will you commit, and we have sent you over 300 letters, will you commit to divesting from policing and violence by policing, and instead investing in what our communities need, which is housing, healthcare,
Danny,
and education?
Danny, who is we?
Who is... So I'm with La Colectiva, and there is also a coalition called the Defund Novo Police Coalition.
Okay.
That
okay.
has been organizing and pressuring.
I just wanted to know who sent the 300 letters, but here is Supervisor Gross.
I think it's a situation of it's not either or, it's and. We need to make sure that our police department is reflective of our community, that our police department has the appropriate training to serve the community. But at the same time, we need to provide mental health treatment opportunities. We need to provide affordable housing. We need to have education opportunities. We need to have the social services. So it's not an either or. It really is. I know that a lot of people have said defund the police. I think when you really look at what we need, it's funding the police and a number of other agencies and organizations that can complement the work that the police do. One of the things that Mr. Davis said in his interviews with me was a difference between some communities that are policed and some communities that are protected. And there is very much a difference in those in that terminology. Policed is rather negative. Protected is a positive element. And what we need to do is make sure that in our police department and in our community, that the community is all protected, not just policed. And this
Allow
is
me
a
to
lot
enter-
of the community policing that we have to do.
Tom Sherwood, we only have a little more than a minute left, but go ahead, please.
Oh, I wanted to follow up on the police because Mr. McKay, the chairman of the board, said the history of policing is not centered around the safety of all members of our community. He expects the new chief to do that. I got to ask a political question. You've endorsed Terry McAuliffe for governor in the June 8th primary. There were a lot of people who have said, why didn't the Democratic Party go with a Black woman and make history in the state? Just briefly, why did you endorse Terry McAuliffe for governor like so many, I think 5 of the 10 board members did?
I've known Terry for many years. I've worked with him. I think that he has the best opportunity, the best chance to do another four years like he did a few years ago. Our governors in Virginia, unfortunately, cannot succeed themselves. So this is an opportunity for, I think it's the second time in history for a previous governor to assume the gubernatorial role.
Okay.
I think Terry is a great spokesperson for Virginia, and I look forward to working
okay.
with him.
Penelope Gross is the vice chair of the Fairfax County Board of Supervisors representing the Mason District. Supervisor Gross, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Up next, Janice Lewis-George, a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 4. I'm Kojo Nambi. Welcome back. Joining us now is Janice Lewis-George, a member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 4. Councilmember Lewis-George, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Kojo and Tom.
Before we get to the district, Tom Sherwood, Dr. David Fowler is the former medical examiner in Maryland. He testified in the trial of the officer who killed George Floyd, and his testimony for a lot of laypersons sounded quite remarkable. Apparently, it sounded remarkable to about 431 doctors also, who wrote a letter, and now apparently he's going to be investigated in Maryland. Why?
Well, he basically said that George Floyd had a heart attack when everyone else said that it was induced by the 9.5 minutes on George Floyd's neck by the officer Derek Chauvin. Dr. Fowler headed the chief medical examiner's office in Maryland from 2003 to 2020, and he retired to go into private consulting business. He had a fairly good reputation, although there were more than a few cases in which people complained about the decisions his office made. And so after he had appeared in that now infamous appearance at the trial, Dr. Roger A. Mitchell, who used to be the medical examiner in D.C., works for Howard now, and those 431 doctors asked that a review be done of all the cases that were handled by Maryland during 2003 and 2020. And Attorney General Brian Frosch and Governor Hogan both agreed that they would do that, and that's what's going to happen. I don't know how long it's going to take, but there is going to be a review of the cases he handled.
So despite the fact that Dr. Fowler had a good reputation or was held in some regard some years ago, his testimony, Tom Sherwood, in the Dennis Chauvin case has caused people to look back at the record again. And there were two cases, I think, in which there were lawsuits filed as a result of his testimony. Is that not correct?
Yes, I know one of them was Tyrone West, who died after struggling with Baltimore police in 2013. And another, I think, in 2018, Antoine Black, a 19-year-old who died in police custody on the Eastern Shore. As we saw in the case, though, over the days that it ran and how quickly the jury came back with a unanimous verdict after just less than 10 hours of deliberation, it just seemed so out of place. Had he not been so out of place with every other medical person, if he could just differ somewhat with them, that would have been different. But it was just a significant difference that alarmed people who are aware that he ran the District of Maryland for almost 20 years.
Well, there are several callers who, as we await the return of Councilmember Janice Lewis-George, who have questions for her. We'll take a couple of them and keep them in mind when she comes along. I think I'll start with Kristen in Brightwood, which, of course, is a part of Ward 4. I happen to live in Brightwood myself. Kristen, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. Thank you for taking my question. I'm the chair of Uptown Main Street, and we are severely concerned about the recent and ongoing gun...
Kristen dropped off, but...
maybe Kennedy Street.
Yeah, fortunately, Kristen had sent us an email also. She identifies, as she said, as the board chair of Uptown Main Street. And she said, I would like to ask if Councilmember Lewis-George will commit to a D.C. council holding a hearing on the recent gun violence in Ward 4, but also across the city. There was a recent daytime shooting at 5th and Kennedy Street Northwest, of which I am aware. And, of course, we do have Councilmember Janice Lewis-George back. Councilmember, can you hear me at this point?
Yes.
I was about to say that it is my understanding that you might be in violation of one of my cardinal rules. Why is April the 30th important in your life?
It is my birthday.
Aha.
Which means I'm hoping the callers will be nice.
Well, my cardinal rule is that you should never work on your birthday, but obviously you are working today.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much for joining us. Many of our listeners might already know you after having ousted Democratic incumbent Brandon Todd from the Ward 4 D.C. Council seat yourself last year. But for those who don't know who you are or why you ran, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, I am a third generation Washingtonian. So I was born and raised actually right here in Ward 4. So I grew up in Ward 4 Kennedy Street neighborhood. I'm a D.C. public school graduate, so I did DCPS all the way through. Also a Howard University School of Law graduate. So I rep our HU Bisons. Prior to me joining the council, I have previously served as an assistant district attorney. Also served as an assistant attorney general for the District of Columbia under Attorney General Carl Racine, and worked as assistant general counsel at the Office of State Superintendent of Education. So I have had a life in both service and as well as in litigation and civil rights advocacy work.
Here's Tom Sherwood with birthday greetings and tough questions. Tom Sherwood.
Well, first of all, welcome to the program. You campaigned very hard and early on to unseat a council member, and you achieved that goal, so congratulations. But the caller who we were taking a call while we were reestablishing connection with you, who is very concerned about the violence on Kennedy Street. As you know, it's longstanding. There have been police there. There haven't been police there. There have been more patrols. Haven't been more patrols. Some people don't like the police officers stationed on the corner. It's an unusual spot in Ward 4 particularly, but what progress is being made, if any, to ease the concerns of people worried about crime and shootings and other matters going on Kennedy Street?
Yeah, I'm glad that you said that, Tom. Obviously, this has been a long-standing issue. You know, as I said earlier, I grew up on Kennedy Street. Right. And the long-time safety issues that our community has confronted there are very personal to me. You know, I was hosting an outdoor office hours yesterday, just blocks away from the shooting happening. You know, and I walk those streets every day, when I'm there, you know, what I'm hearing and what I'm seeing from individuals is, you know, there are a number of young people who want jobs, who some can't get jobs because they're returning citizens, and them being a returning citizen hinders their ability to get jobs, which is why the legislation, when we talk about the legislation that my colleague Robert White has put forward, that's why that's so important. A number of those individuals have suffered from substance abuse issues, which is why when we talk about funding services, like we have to do more for our Department of Behavioral Health Services as well as our Department of Health Services and taking on this crisis with substance abuse issues. And, you know, what we're seeing is that, you know, community members are making efforts. We have a number of blighted properties that have not been deemed blighted. We have a number of developments that are vacant and have been vacant for a while, which also contributes to the problems there. So when I look at what we need to do on Kennedy Street, you know, for me, it's an all hands on deck effort. MPDs there already. They're sitting there. They have vehicles out there at the location between 5th and 7th and Kennedy. So MPD's already there. What we don't have there is Department of Employment Services mobile vehicle getting young men signed up to job services. What we don't have is DBH there giving support as far as substance abuse issues. What we don't have there is the adequate funding for our Office of Neighborhood Safety Engagement. At this moment, who only has two violence interrupters that we can fund to our community. So it's not about the service. It's not about you know, what's happening there. It's about what's not happening there. And so that's why I want to see an all hands on deck approach to solving crime, solving the issues of public safety on Kennedy Street.
May I follow up? Yes, please.
You have supported some of the legislation changing how police act. Some people complain that you want to defund police. I don't think you've gone that far. But what changes in the council have been made that will help the police do a better job other than sitting in their squad cars?
Well, I mean, for me, when I look at public safety, it's coming from my perspective of working at the Attorney General's office. And when I was in the public safety division, what I found is that We had neighborhoods that had high gun violence, meaning gun violence happening every single day, and then high crime. So you're talking armed carjackings, robberies, attempt murder, murder. In those neighborhoods, when we put more officers there, we didn't see we wouldn't see a decrease in the crime there. But when we put more violence interrupters, when we put more pathways, programs, and city services, we did see a reduction. And then when it came to us being able to put the implement those services, everyone would say, oh, well, we're limited because we don't have funding for it. And I'm like, well, if it's working, why don't we have funding for it? And so, you know, I really think that, you know, what have we done? What we need to do for us to be able to support MPD is actually doing the out of work that MPD can't do and shouldn't be doing, right? We look at MPD as the means to solve all of our problems, and they're not, they're there to be reactive. That's what they do. They react to policing, but we don't do the work to have the proactive work, the preventative work that needs to happen. So what we could do as a council is fund our other services that will help decrease crime so that MPD can better, can do their, the jobs that they need to do. So okay. It is about, that's how we help MPD, by making the investments in health and education and services. Okay.
24% of Ward 4 residents are fully vaccinated, according to coronavirus.dc.gov. Across D.C., just over 20% of residents are fully vaccinated, so your ward is above average for the district. How is the rollout going in Ward 4, and how do you think it could be improved?
Yeah, you know, Ward 4 is we've really had a collective approach here in the ward, working with our faith community, working with our ANC commissioners, working with our villages, our senior villages, to get individuals vaccinated. And so we've been really putting our vaccine efforts here in the ward have really been a local grassroots effort. So we have a volunteer-driven outreach program. And individuals have been going out, knocking doors, organizing large scale door knocking to basically meet people where they are to make sure they know how to get registered. We have phone banking, and then we had one-on-one door knocking. So we recognized early on that there were some gaps. There were the age gap issue. There was a digital equity gap, right? Everybody doesn't have access to internet to be able to sign up and do that work. Everybody doesn't have access to internet, so they're not getting the information. We also saw a language gap there, where, okay, you know, Ward 4 has one of the largest Amharic and Spanish-speaking populations in the district. And so because we recognize those barriers, we realized the only way to address those barriers is to meet people where they are. So we started going to the grocery stores. We were at Safeway, yep, asking people, have you been vaccinated? We can sign you up here. So I accredit, you know, Ward 4's efforts to the collective work we've done as a community, especially with Department of Health and DPR helping us along the way.
But as you and I both know, there is still some significant skepticism, particularly among African Americans, about the vaccination. I read on the Council Members Corner in Petworth News that you got your vaccine with your mom at Le Monde Recreation Center earlier this month. And I think a part of that had to do with the aforementioned skepticism. Tell us about why you wrote about it.
Yeah, you know, I wrote about it because what I was hearing in our community specifically is people were saying, oh, I'll wait to get the vaccine. And I would say, well, why, what are you waiting for? Oh, well, I think they need to work out, you know, maybe they need to work out some of the kinks. And I'm like, what? Work out kinks? And I realized that we hadn't done a good job of educating people on how vaccines are developed. You know, I said vaccines are developed by testing and having a waiting period and doing all these things. And what I found is that, you know, our community had a lot of questions, and it wasn't a matter of just me saying get vaccinated. It was describing why get vaccinated. And once my mom made the decision to get vaccinated, then my aunt started feeling comfortable, and then my aunts got vaccinated. And, you know, that's why it was so important to have credible messengers of the community, which is why I think our faith community has done such a great job, you know, doing that. But I got my vaccine to show my community that the vaccine is effective and safe. But I got it with my mom because, you know, she was scared. And many of our community members were scared just because of the history of vaccines in the Black community with Tuskegee, et cetera. And so that trauma and then being scared is a very real fact that we have to face. And so we all have to do our part to not just give the information and get people to do it. You can't shame people into getting vaccinated, but you can inform them into getting vaccinated, and you can lead by example. So I just wanted to be honest with my neighbors and everyone that these are real. This is what's happening in real homes every day, where many of my friends have had to convince their aunties, their uncles, their grandparents to get vaccinated.
Here's Mark. Oh, Mark just dropped off. Here is Perry in Brightwood. Perry, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Kojo. Good afternoon, council member, and congratulations on your office.
Thank you.
I'm resident of Ward 4, and I wanted to ask you about MPD's response and what your position and actions may or may not be regarding getting answers from MPD. MPD has been involved in the chase death of Caron Hilton in October 2020, mm-hmm. and the community still does not know what...
Well, Perry, allow me to interrupt because we're running out of time, and this gives Councilmember Lewis George the opportunity to talk about the fact that she and five other council members introduced a bill that would limit when police can engage in car chases. Could you explain that bill and how it would limit what police can do?
Yeah, so I introduced the Law Enforcement Vehicular Pursuit Reform Act of 2021. A bill to protect basically the safety of residents by restricting the use of police chases. Obviously, a beloved community member in Ward 4, Caron Hilton Brown, was killed during a police chase last fall over a traffic stop, driving a moped on a sidewalk, and he was chased on a moped through narrow streets in the community before colliding with another vehicle and losing his life. And so Caron should be with us today. Jeffrey Price, who died almost exactly 3 years ago after a police chase, also should still be here. And so at the protests and vigils we had in Ward 4, Caron's friends, family, and community spoke out and were clear that they didn't want this to happen again. And so it's not for me to make sure that this doesn't happen again. I thought it's really important for us to change the way we do police pursuits here. And police chases are inherently dangerous for everyone, including those being chased, officers and bystanders. And so what my legislation does is restrict police chases in D.C. cases to when an individual has committed a violent crime and continues to pose a serious threat.
Here's Tom Sherwood.
Thank you. Just on back to COVID, tomorrow, Saturday, there's the mayor's having a May 1st day of action all around the city. You know, you can get a vaccination now without registration, just do walk-ups. So people should pay attention to that if they are looking. I have a political question for you. Want to clear up something left over from the campaign. A year ago in April of 2020, a city worker tore down hundreds of your signs on New York Avenue and Georgia Avenue. You complained about that properly. The DPW Public Works said it was a mistake by a new employee, but I've since learned that you have actually, your campaign filed a complaint with the Office of Risk Management asking that you be reimbursed, I was told, $300 per sign, and that case is still active and that there's more than 100 signs, which would be something like $30,000. What is the status of your case? Did you, in fact, file it with the Office of Risk Management, your campaign? And are you still looking for a settlement with the city that you now represent?
Yeah, you know.
How much is it?
Honestly, we did have our campaign signs were taken down.
Right, we know that, but how much money are you asking for the signs that were taken down? Some were returned, but not some were destroyed. So, how much is your complaint for?
I think
is it $30,000?
We filed for reimbursement for about I don't have it on me because my treasurer is a better person. I want to say we filed for about $3,000 to cover the signs and the staff time.
So a total of $3,000, not $30,000.
No, not $30,000 for sure. I'm pretty sure it was about $3,000 to cover the signs and the staff time.
Okay, and are you pursuing that still? Yeah, and then we'll let it go. Are you still pursuing the money?
I believe if it hasn't been closed out, then it's still in pursuit.
Okay. All right. Thank you for the update.
There's an ongoing investigation. There's an ongoing investigation into D.C.'s crime lab, spurred by allegations that leaders concealed some findings and changed results in firearm cases. How much do you know about this, and what's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that, this is another issue. I know these things are so important, and with cases, many of our cases in the criminal justice system hinge on, the data that comes back from the lab. And so it's a very serious question of if the evidence is correct and if the chain of custody is correct. And, I'm deeply alarmed about what this means for our criminal justice system, especially when so many cases hinge on what comes back from labs. There's always been historically, even when I was working at the Attorney General's office, there's always been also a backup at the lab. And so a number of cases would sit for months. And when I say cases are sitting, that means individuals sometimes were sitting in prison waiting for their trial to be called and things things to develop, and it was taking a long time for that to happen. And so, I think the council had a roundtable on this earlier this week where we tried to get answers and correct course, but there are many outstanding concerns that I hope will get resolved. And I trust that my colleague, Charles Allen, chair of the judiciary, is working to do those.
You know, for a while, we've been considering D.C. to have nearly 713,000 residents. But according to the 2020 census data, we have just under 690,000 residents. Of course, those numbers were collected during the pandemic. Are you concerned that there might be an undercount?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm concerned. I'm not just concerned locally, but I'm concerned nationally. The former president, Trump and his administration, did everything possible to chill, individuals, not fearing, with the census. We talk about our immigrant communities and, the hate that is still happening as a result of Donald Trump. I absolutely don't trust what we have right now is accurate, just because during that time we even know that the administration didn't even have all the funds there that needed to be there to actually conduct this. So, yeah, I do think there's an undercount, and it's a direct result of our president, current president, the former president.
And I'm afraid that's just about all the time we have. Janice Lewis-George is the member of the D.C. Council representing Ward 4, and she's actually working on her birthday. Go do something fun, please.
I will.
And thank you very much for joining us. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Any big plans this weekend, Tom Sherwood?
Well, I'm going to go out and watch, see what happens on this day of action to see if anybody's really going to get shots. That's tomorrow, Saturday.
The producer for the Politics Hour is Sydney Grannan. We'll see you all next week. Thank you all for listening. Have a great weekend and stay safe. I'm Kojo Nandi.
The Politics Hour with Kojo Nandi is produced by Sydney Grannan. Our managing producer is Ingalisa Schrobstor. Our broadcast engineer is Rashad Young. Today's engineer was Mike Kidd. Mona Kashvi oversees all the content we make here at WAMU. For past shows and more content, visit thepoliticshour.org.